The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. There's a lot going on, a lot in the papers today, and not all COVID related, you might be relieved to hear. And we've a panel here raring to go as well, so let's just romp through the front pages. Sunday Independent, Varadkar death threats are credible. The tarnished are now under armed guard as security is ramped up. Also, little story there. Over 34,000 people arrived into the state, including over 1,200 from high-risk areas of Brazil and South Africa in the three-week period after the government signed off on mandatory hotel quarantines. And then a sidebar story there, I'll read the headline. Neffert warns vaccines will offer limited protection. You'd be tempted to say, leave us alone, leave us alone. We're barely coping. The Business Post, government split on Garda presence at hotels during quarantine. The Department of Health wanted Gardaí at hotels, but the Gardaí and the Department of Justice opposed the idea. And Michael Brennan, who wrote that story, has a great piece inside on the pitfalls of quarantine hotels and what can go wrong and what with the lessons we could learn from Australia and New Zealand. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Taoiseach is out of touch, same ministers. None of them named, you'll be disappointed to hear. But yeah, they're saying the public are losing faith with COVID rules. That's a new poll as well. We'll have a look at that poll in more detail in a while. The Sunday Times, COVID bounce helps RTE back into 5 million profit. And this is according to Eugene McMahon, an independent financial advisor who examined RTE's books at the request of the unions. And this is in the context of the pay row, I suppose you'd call it, that's going on here in RTE that you might have heard about. They also have that on the Sunday Times, confidence plunges amid vaccine pause. Now, it didn't quite plunge, I would say, but there was a poll done on Monday and 67% of people would definitely take the vaccine, down from 72%. But that was Monday, remember, when uncertainty was still very much at its height. It might have settled down during the week. They also have on the side there, Simon Harris has told detectives that he was asked to leak the GP document that Leo Varadkar leaked, but he did not do so. So, good for him. The Irish Sunday Mirror, RTE pay war, and RTE is headed for the Industrial Relations Tribunal if staff don't agree to pay cuts. And that's from an interview that the DG did yesterday on the business of Richard Curran. The Irish Sun on Sunday, fair play to Ken Sweeney. He's cranked a second day out of this row between Dancing with the Stars, George Brian Redmond and Davy Fitz. And the Sunday World Whig stock market collapse. So this is a gangland figure, Graham Whelan. The cab raided him and he had shares purchased through Davies and he had a 58k Rolex watch and cash as well. Okay, and to mulch over all that and a lot more, our panel today, Richard Corrigan is a restaurateur, Kate O'Connell is a pharmacist and of course a former Fine Gael TD, and Kevin Doyle joining us remotely is Group Head of News at INM. And good morning, and you're all very welcome, and we'll get some expert input as the hour goes on as well. Richard Corrigan, you're all experts too, Kate O'Connell, I beg your pardon. But you know, there's only one kind of expert these days. And Richard Corrigan, I think people might be semi-surprised that you're here in Ireland. Obviously, you have a money pit of a pile up in Cavan, but your empire largely based in London. Have you been in London?
I came back to Ireland on the 3rd of January. I done my NHS test in Alexandria Park and all was clear, and I came here because being locked up in a city or being locked up in a forest, I know where I want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I can well imagine. Okay. Let's start with these death threat story. Kevin Doyle, there seems to be two death threat stories in the Sunday Independent today about Leo Varadkar. There's a story inside as well about unionists threatening southern politicians. But the one on the front page, can you talk us through that? This is a different set of death threats, is it?
Yeah, there's two strands really to it, Brendan. But I suppose they all lead to the same conclusion, which is that Leo Varadkar has some people out there who are really against him, to the point where there is now a credible belief among Gardaí that physical violence could be come upon him, and they have upped his security levels. We saw during the week there was an incident up in the north in East Belfast where his home address was scrawled across a wall in graffiti. That is one element that perhaps has not been looked at as seriously, not that it's not been taken seriously, but that to some extent has been seen as loyalists perhaps trying to intimidate or to set the agenda around the Northern Ireland Protocol. But the front page story in the Sunday Independent seems to be more localised, and it's a series of recent death threats. So it's not just one incident. Some of them have been of a homophobic nature. And it has reached the point now where the special detective unit, which provides armed protection to the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, the Foreign Affairs Minister, Michael D. Higgins, kind of those level of VIPs, now believe that Leo Varadkar needs it 24 hours a day. And, you know, he would normally have a Garda driver, or if he's out on official business in the public eye, he would normally have somebody with him. But when, you know, when he gets back to his house, when he's over visiting family or whatever, well, not that you can do that at the moment, no. But what you do in normal life, there would be less pressure on that. He wouldn't have a Garda on his shoulder all the time, but it seems that now they believe he needs to have one all the time.
Okay, and listen, lest anyone think that we're just going to talk about Leo Varadkar death threats today and we've been distracted away from the other Leo Varadkar story, we'll come to it in a minute, okay? So don't get up in arms. Kate, what do you make of this?
It's very concerning that people who are trying to work in the public interest are subject to threats like this. I'm sure it's very concerning. It's been emerging over a number of years. I dealt with it myself as a politician, but also...
In what way?
Well, it depended on what the issue was. Obviously, the Eighth Amendment brought a certain amount of impact on my personal life and my business. At one stage, a senator by accident put my home address on a circular, and that gave my address out there. Which meant that we had a number of people call to our home. I had no actual threat to my life at any point, apart from on paper. I never had a physical threat to my life.
But you got what? You got letters?
Oh, I got plenty of letters, plenty sent to my business, plenty of my staff attacked in the shop, political
verbally
reasons,
attacked.
Verbally attacked in the shop, in the shops. My husband constantly been subject to questioning as to what was going on in the world of politics in his own private business. But like that, we saw this with Simon Harris. I remember when his wife had their baby Saoirse. There was a protest outside their home, and I remember thinking, God, if I was wheeling my new baby and there was people outside my home, I would be terrified. And then we saw recently Stephen Donnelly, and Stephen's kids, as far as I know, his boys are the same age as mine. They're around, give or take, the same. They're all under 10 or so. And like, it's one thing having a threat against Stephen Donnelly, but to try and explain that to a 10 or 12 year old, you know, why you'd put extra security. So, you know, this is going on. It's becoming much more prevalent. And I think it's fueled by social media, and that there's kind of nothing is off limits now, and that people attack the person and their personal life and are unable to separate the politician from their job.
And did you get written death threats in letters sent to you?
There was various. I was shielded from a lot of it, but there was definitely, you know, I hope you die, and I hope, you know, you choke to death, a painful death, or this sort of stuff, mad stuff, you know.
Yeah, and did you view it as that, just mad stuff, or I mean, it must worry you on some level.
Well, it
anyway,
didn't worry me. I mean, I think the only thing that worried me were the visits to the home. And the impact on my staff as such, because I mean, they were just normal people going about their job, lots of them, you know, not in any way political. But like that, I think every politician nearly has an element of this in their life, no matter what party you're from. I'd say probably everybody has some example of how they were threatened either online or in person. And it's something that I don't think is acceptable, because I think there's a coarseness again after sneaking in with COVID. And just something I've noticed through the course of operating a business, people actually would say things to you now that they'd never say to you. It's almost like the lines between reality and the virtual world have been blurred. And people often say things now to your face or publicly that you kind of go a couple of years ago wouldn't have been acceptable. But I do think in order to get people to go into public life and for it to be worth it, it's very important that safety is maintained. And during the Eighth Amendment, it would have been fairly tricky. I remember the Minister for Health at the time, Simon Harris, we used to always check how we could get out of a room when we went into it. Yeah. And that was, you know, just, I suppose, a survival mechanism, that you never went into a room to make a speech on the Eighth Amendment unless you knew how you were going to get out of it if things got tough. And that's the way it was. And I don't think it's acceptable. Yeah. And I don't think that, you know, you're going to get people into politics if there's a threat there against their family.
That's it, Richard, isn't it? Why would anyone talented or who would good options in the private sector or whatever for a hassle enough free life, why would they draw this on themselves?
Well, just listening to that alone, I mean, bringing in legislation on the Eighth Amendment and anything that brings progressive a modern view to society.
A lot of people will disagree on that, but it doesn't matter. You can disagree on it.
I think since 2016, I've noticed people on the hard right and the religious lunatics basically have a lot more to say, probably in the last 5 to 6 years. You know what I mean? I mean, wait till we bring in euthanasia. You know what I mean? What's going to happen then? You know what I mean? Which should have been brought in probably 20 years ago. But the fact of the matter is, politicians need protecting of all sides if they're coming under extreme views. The views from the north, from the loyalist side, you know what I mean? I mean, being on that border counties, you know what I mean? I kind of feel the north very close to my heart in many ways, and have for probably 35, 40 years. And I just think we can't just see the unionist kind of abandoned to no leadership. And I think people like Coveney and Radcar, we need to be careful how we say things regarding the North, say things regarding Brexit, say things regarding the protocol. And I think, you know, silent diplomacy is the best when it comes to Irish diplomacy.
And so are you saying, can you understand why unionism might be? I think there's a line in the piece inside about the unionist antipathy towards them, that one of the loyalists says something about their identity being eroded. Can you feel how they might feel their identity is being eroded by that border in the sea?
Yeah, I do. I've always, you know, I know the North kind of well, you know what I mean? So I've always felt a kind of a sympathy with the loyalists. I've always known in my heart and soul, as every decade has gone on, their minority kind of status is coming, and will, you know, the nationalist or the Catholic majority in the north is not too far off. And, you know, everyone just shouting kind of United Ireland, which will come in its own time. But we need to be inclusive of bringing everyone in together, not alienating a minority that's coming to be a minority into feeling how the nationalists felt in 1968. So I just think there needs to be really proper, we need to be very careful if you're in public office to what comes out of your mouth and how you say it. And I think we can be a lot more diplomatic. And Ireland is very good at diplomacy. I've seen it in the ambassadors all over Europe, and especially in London. We are masters at it.
Would anyone disagree with that? Kate? Kevin?
Well, I suppose there's, despite people's, I suppose, reasons or beliefs, I don't think there's ever an excuse to threaten violence against the likes of the Foreign Affairs Minister, the Taoiseach. So I understand where Richard is coming from, and I do think it's very important, the sensitivities of political situations, and everyone's a little bit extra sensitive at the minute as well with COVID, just in general. So I do think it's important to bring all parts with you. And I can understand the loyalists' view that they feel more separated than ever, perhaps. But like that, that's diplomacy, and you have to work with people. And violence, as we all know, never ever solved anything.
Okay, let's move on to then, I suppose, what you might call the broader issue around Leo Varadkar. Kevin, what you picked out this Simon Harris piece on the front of the Sunday Times in terms of the ongoing investigation into Leo Varadkar and the leaking of that document.
Yeah, there's quite a lot about Leo the Leak, as it's called today, Brendan. And it's kind of funny because we've moved into the leaks about the leaks stage of the Garda investigation that's taking place. So we're learning almost blow by blow of what's going on in the Garda investigation through leaks, wherever they're coming from. So there's a certain irony in that. But one of the things to emerge today is that Simon Harris, who we already knew had given a statement to Gardaí several weeks back at this stage, but apparently in that he revealed that he had been asked for this same document unsolicited by the same person, the same GP that had asked Leo Varadkar for
Matthew O'Toole, we can say his name, I think, can't we?
Reason not to. And he is quoted saying he expects that he's likely to be spoken to by the guards at some stage, but hasn't as of yet. So it seems Matthew O'Toole asked for the document from Simon Harris. Simon Harris gave a kind of vague commitment that he'd go away and see what he did, but nothing ever came of it. It's not really clear whether he actually tried to get it and give it to him or not.
How does that reflect on Leo Varadkar and on the whole thing?
Well, I suppose it just feeds more into the narrative. It shows, first of all, that I suppose the NAGP, the organisation at the centre of this, were looking. There's a suggestion that they were kind of looking left, right and centre to get this document. They were very, very keen to get this GP contract, which they weren't privy to. And I suppose the question for Leo Varadkar here is that he's the one who gave it to them, and he was at the top of the food chain, if you like. He was Taoiseach at the time. And this is what's landed him in a mess. And there's absolutely no doubt, and it's reflected, I think, across a lot of the coverage today, that his reputation, regardless of what happens in the next few weeks, is so badly damaged by what has played out here. The idea that the former Taoiseach, future Taoiseach and current Taoiseach is subject of a Garda investigation in this way, it's just very damaging. And the fact that he's the leader of Fine Gael, he's not. I think there is real trouble here for Leo Varadkar, and people around him say he is worried, because aside from what happens in terms of the Garda investigation, as leader of Fine Gael, the party of law and order, and Kate might speak to this, but this isn't Bertie Ahern. You know, there was this talk that he was the new Bertie, he had this Teflon kind of scenario, but Leo Varadkar hasn't led Fine Gael to three glorious election victories back to back. So people within his party won't tolerate this in the same way that some of Bertie Ahern's shenanigans were tolerated for so long in Fianna Fáil.
Would you agree with that, Kate? Do you think he's in trouble here?
I do. I don't like seeing anybody in trouble, but I do think it is very concerning for the party. I am a member of Fine Gael. And when you have the leader of a party subject to a criminal investigation, it just wouldn't sit well, in my view, with the membership of the party. And I'd imagine, a bit like what Kevin said...
Hang on. Can we just a bit of perspective here for a second? One is we're reading leaks which potentially come from the Gardaí or Simon Harris or whoever was privy to that statement on the front of the paper today. The other side of it is that, like, the media exists on leaks from the government. You think that he could go down now for a leak?
Oh, I don't know, but to my mind, there's no equation between somebody leaking.
But I mean, even the sniffiness about it from members of the party, who presumably have all leaked in their day as well.
There is a criminal investigation going on here, and I think I have to be very careful not to say anything that would in any way affect that,
but it's not stopping everybody else, including Leo Varadkar, from liberally discussing this on the air.
My point here is that there was a confidential, it appears, there was a confidential document leaked. I was in the Dáil at the time. There was a lot of talk about it. I was on the Health Committee.
Obvious, what was the talk?
About that contract.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this all stands back, and not to bore everybody to death on a Sunday morning, but the High Court ruled that the IMO were the negotiating body for the doctors, and this arose from the cuts that happened at the last recession. And pharmacists were kind of similar to the GPs, contractors with the state. And those unilateral cuts came in, and the High Court decided that the IMO would be the sole body, and therefore they would have access to the contract. So this contract, whether it was in the public domain or not, and I don't know whether all details were in, and none of us know that yet, but the fact is that it was a valuable document to an organisation that wasn't entitled to it. Clearly, if they were looking for it that much. But like that, that's up to the DPP and the Guard and Gardaí to decide.
And there is nothing. They're investigating to see if a law was broken.
Absolutely,
stage,
and nobody has said that anybody has broken a law yet. And that's the job of the DPP to decide, not myself, yourself, or anybody else. But in terms of the party, it is always going to be damaging if you have a leader that's subject to a criminal investigation. Like, that can never be a positive. And like that, as Kevin said. Bertie Ahern at the time was going off the back of a lot of electoral success. But in terms of Fine Gael, and obviously I have a certain amount of bias here, Brendan, because I wouldn't have supported Leo Varadkar in the leadership. I wonder when Leo's going to deliver for Fine Gael. I really wonder, like he delivered for other people. I wonder when he's going to deliver more seats. I mean, there was, at the leadership time, it was about gaining seats, momentum for the party, a new vision for the party, a new future for the party. And I know obviously with COVID things have gone a bit tricky, but I'd imagine people are looking at it and going, you know, if there's anything in this, it will be damaging. But if there's nothing, I think he's fine.
Okay, so if there's nothing, which a lot of people course, do seem to think that there will be nothing,
why would
then,
there be?
Then it moves on. You don't think it's under the waterline damage anyway?
And it shouldn't be. If somebody hasn't actually done something wrong, and that is decided by the An Gardaí, well, that's they're clear.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody should be dragged, I suppose, through the newspapers in the way that perhaps is happening at the minute, unless I suppose there's a perception that something will happen. I think innocent until proven guilty.
So you think, is this dragging out of it? And I think Leo Varadkar has kind of expressed his own frustration, maybe through channels or maybe he said directly, that he hasn't been spoken to yet and he'd like to be spoken to, but I mean, apparently they're going to do the whole investigation before
normal.
They come and speak
that's
to
standard.
Him. Yeah.
But that is standard.
Yeah.
But he's trying to do his daily work.
The fact that it's being dragged on and the fact that we're reading people's statements in the papers, do you think that's unfair?
Well, I think it's slightly unfair. And I also think he's the tarnish to the country and he's trying to do his job at the minute.
Okay.
And I can imagine that this is quite difficult for him. But what I would like to say is, though, that there has been a focus in terms of the party on one person, like Leo Varadkar, as the centre of the party. And if you build around a single entity, well, then if something happens to that single entity, it has a negative ripple effect throughout the party.
Do you think that's true, Kevin? Is Fine Gael largely built around one person right now?
Well, it probably is now more so than it was even before the last election, to be fair, because in some ways Fine Gael's presence at cabinet has been diluted by the fact that they've had to go into a three-way coalition. So, you know, we don't see... It used to be Simon Coveney as Taoiseach, it used to be Simon Harris as Health Minister, and all these people have kind of gone down the pecking order now because we have, well, obviously Leo Varadkar in as Taoiseach. So yes, there is, I think he is kind of the man in the limelight. And it's interesting, in the Mail, their Ireland Thinks poll today, and maybe this speaks to Kate's point a little bit, Leo Varadkar's popularity has gone down a little bit. He's below Mary Lou MacDonald, although still ahead of Micheál Martin. But perhaps more interestingly, he's now in behind Simon Coveney, Pascal Donoghue and Simon Harris in the popularity stakes. And that wouldn't have really been the case in the past, or at least he'd been up there with them. So
does kind of disprove the point about though that the party's built around one person, because you would say Pascal Donoghue, strong brand in his own way. Simon Coveney, strong brand in his own way. Simon Harris, strong brand. Okay. And look, that's probably going to drag on and on. But look, let's get on to, the big issue that's facing most of us in our lives now, and that is the COVID. And I suppose the conversation at the moment is kind of around the potential reopening or non-reopening, or what we can do or what we can't do or anything. Richard, where are you at now? Again, straddling the two jurisdictions.
I am in Ireland. I'm going to tell you exactly where we are. I got a message from the NHS 2 weeks ago saying that to apply to the NHS on my NHS app to get my COVID injection. Now, I don't want to put two dates to get. Now, I didn't want those two dates, I'll be honest with you.
Pity about you, Carrigan.
I didn't want those two dates, but I only want the dates when I head back to London in April. So I didn't want to take two dates and not use them. But I'll tell you how efficient they are. I got two more texts on my phone this week. One from the Muswell Hill practice, NHS practice, saying, Richard, you didn't fill in your internet thing. Bump. And one yesterday came again. So clearly...
They're begging you to have a vaccination.
Clearly, the organisation
You're sickening
aspect,
people all over the country
The organisation aspect behind it, they've got their act together at last. It took them a long time.
Yeah.
They went for the herd. They went for everything. They went for... I mean, God only knows knows how many deaths is going to be in the UK after this. But the NHS and everyone, I'm going to say the NHS because it's not a government thing. The NHS has certainly got their act together and they're 100% on top of it. And I think coming up here this morning, listening to the radio saying that they're starting on 75s, just seems odd.
Okay, and
with
in
May
terms then
and
of
summer around the corner,
and then you're back to London when and reopening your restaurants.
All outside eating starts on the 12th of April, and then 5 weeks later, all restaurants basically London opens up again. UK opens up.
Okay, you confident about it?
I would say that I'm not going to be too optimistic. I've seen so many closures, startups and closures again, but they seem to be on top of it. And if they have enough vaccine to do everyone, I think they'll stay on top of it.
Okay. And then you have what's largely a wedding venue up in Virginia, isn't
it? No, it's a grow operation. It's a farm. It's a grow operation that supplies my London restaurants. And then it's a private estate that does weddings as well. And we have an outside glamping operation as well in the Woodlands, 12 Shepherd's Huts.
Okay, so when do you think you might see a prospect in any of that opening?
That really concerns us, you know, that really worries me, that we haven't seen any indication of anything happening on that front. Big silence, you know what I mean, maybe bits of rumours of May, now it's June. I mean, you know, it's very concerning.
Like, people would imagine that you're kind of a big enough player who's probably okay to keep taking over financially and you'll open.
Well,
again.
Very honestly, I'm going to be totally frank with you, Brendan. You know, I'm in the cash flow business with our restaurants. You know what I mean? I don't have gold bars and accounts. I rely on banking, and AIB is my banker. And basically, if AIB, you know what I mean, decides whatever, you know, I'm in their hands one way or the other. And basically, you know, we haven't gone for overall big government loans in the UK because you have to start paying them back next October. So 20% of all my furlough in the UK I pay, you know what I mean, really. It's you have the running costs of your business, right? My electric bill in Virginia Park Lodge was $7,500 in January. My gas bill for January, February was $7,750. You know, no offence, how much... We'll be on our knees by the time we get open.
Will a lot of people not be back? Not come back after this? A lot of restaurants and stuff.
Their businesses coming back?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think any young business will find it very, very hard. I mean, there's two aspects to this. I lease my restaurants in London. I own Virginia Park Lodge. So therefore, I have a lot more flexibility with a place like Virginia Park Lodge because I own it.
Yeah.
In London, I have three landlords. I have Derwent, I have the Qataris, and I have Crown Estate, probably three of the biggest landlords in London. Now, we won't mention them again going forward in conversations.
Okay, but be careful now.
We've been having conversation with them for the last year. One of them didn't answer me for 6 months. One of them completely ignored there was even a problem. There was only one, which I'm going to mention, is Derwent.
No, don't, because now you've told us who the other
Derwent.
Two are. Okay, They dealt with it in such a positive manner. Okay, good for them.
And they set the tone. So frankly,
and the other two aren't here, and I'm sure there's
Brendan,
two sides
is
to it,
in
yeah.
real difficulties with landlords.
Yeah.
Because a lot of landlords, what I'm hearing for is asking for full payment for last year.
Okay, so if we take the Irish situation, is there anything the government can do here? They can't open up the country in the morning. They are, like, the supports for business, I think everyone agrees, have been great. Is there anything they could be doing differently?
Until the health green light goes on, I don't think there's very little to be done.
Okay, all right. And to that end, I'm going to talk to Aoife McLeister, Professor of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin. Aoife, good morning.
Good morning.
Aoife, you're in the piece with you in the Mail today. And one of the things you're saying is that, just to set the context for you, people will know that you're part of the independent scientific advocacy group. So you're largely in favour of so-called zero COVID. But you were saying today that you think that the restrictions and the lockdown and such could be a bit more nuanced.
Well, the idea is basically what we call a green zone idea. It isn't unique to us. We didn't invent it. It's an idea that's around the world. And it's basically that you treat different areas differently depending on the facts on the ground. And one of the things we see at the moment is the situation is not the same over the whole country. But we're treating the whole country the same. And there are parts of the country now where the numbers are really right down. You know, when you look at even at a county level, which is relatively coarse, you'll see counties that are consistently less than five cases a day. And then you see Dublin and some other counties where it's really, really high. And so we're opening the schools kind of on the same day in all of the counties, even though the primary schools especially like would have been safe, you know, back in beginning of February, probably in lots of parts of the country. And there's still parts of Dublin where it's not necessarily safe. I know a woman who lives in the west of Dublin. She is high risk. She has a heart condition. She's young, like she's less than 40, but she has a pacemaker and everything. And in her region of Dublin, it's some of the highest cases in the country. And so she didn't send her children back to school because she feels it's too unsafe for her. So, you know, treating the whole country like a block is not necessarily the way to go. We need to think about there are differences and we can treat different parts of the country differently. And that has multiple positive effects then as well, you know, because then it tells people what they're aiming for. This lockdown has been going on far too long.
And then you essentially, that county or area needs to be pretty much sealed from other areas then, yeah?
It depends on how you do it. Like if you open just the schools, for example, like you don't shop around for a school, so that's the easy one. But if you start opening other things, like if you start opening retail and hairdressers and things like that, then you have the potential that, of course, you'll be luring in people from other COVID hotspots. So, and that's kind of the mistake we made last summer. You know, one of the mistakes we made last summer when we reopened was we didn't protect the gains. You know, well, it was on a bigger scale because we let the cases back in from outside the country. But, you know, when you have the gains, you need to protect them. So if you just opened the schools, it wouldn't be a problem because you don't shop around for a school, like I say. But if you were opening hospitality, then, of course, people would be drawn to that. So you would, that's the price to pay. So either you have to wait till the whole country is ready.
And Aoife, sorry, you would be suggesting that if a place has it virtually, there's no cases for a week or two in summer, that you would open up shops, hospitality and stuff, yeah?
If you can protect it, yes. Otherwise, if you're not willing to protect the gains, then you're saying that the whole country has to wait. But this goes alongside some other things, you know, in that we have not yet properly resourced our public health units. And this is a really important thing.
Totally take on that point, and it's been well made a lot. Listen, in terms of where we stand at the moment, right, I suppose the question a lot of people have is this, right, that we have a dilemma here. On one hand, people are saying, we can't take this anymore. We need something on April the 5th. On the other hand, we're looking at what's going on around Europe, and we're saying, maybe if we let up at all, this B117 just goes rampant again. Is there anything we can do in terms of nuanced, targeted things? Maybe, to do with this outdoors life or whatever. Is there anything we can give people to make life more bearable in the short term while we wait for the vaccines to have more of an effect?
Well, I think the main thing is we don't say we'll just wait for the vaccines. There are things that we could be doing to really get the numbers back under control well before the vaccines. And there are there are things that can be done. So you're asking me, can we let people go and do, pleasurable activities? But I think it's more important that we get the numbers right down. And we should have the numbers right down now based on the amount of time we spent in lockdown. The problem is this lockdown has been sufficiently inconsistent that it hasn't been good enough. You know, as we see, we've just got to kind of steady numbers. If you look nationwide, numbers are kind of steady rather than decreasing. And that suggests that a release is going to go back into exponential growth very, very quickly. So there are things that have to be done, but those things should have been done. Unfortunately, it's been clear since January that this was the pattern, that, you know, the B117 was stubborn against the level of lockdown we currently have.
If we think that people are not keeping to what's there at the moment, and the idea is that we have to go harder, is there any benefit to be said for let the government and the restrictions and everybody get back on the same page so that we give people a livable level of restriction, but people actually start keeping to it again? Because I think everyone agrees now that there are a lot of people who are just letting slippage happen across the board.
But some of that slippage is not necessarily voluntary. So there are people who are being required to attend their workplaces, and workplace transmission has been recognised as an important aspect of the high caseloads at the moment. And that's not necessarily employees deciding they want to go to work. It's employers requiring them to be there. Some of these people are public sector workers as well. So the government needs to lead by example. We have public sector, public servants who are required to attend their workplaces. We also have very obvious things we should be doing. Like when we're asking people to isolate. Not everybody has a place to isolate. We know that there's a problem with overcrowding in accommodation and asking somebody to isolate when they've got nowhere to isolate. So I think there are things, it's not, there are lots of individuals who cannot do any more. I think the majority are actually doing everything.
Yeah.
And there are people who are at home and they're going, what are you doing? You ask me to stay at home harder. I mean, there's nothing more I can do. But that's not where it is. The gaps in what's currently happening are gaps in things that government can do. They're putting, there's things that they should have done before now so that we would actually be out of lockdown by now. But unfortunately, we aren't. So, but I think if we, relaxing the restrictions is not necessarily the way to go
okay.
as a country, because we don't have scope for that at the moment, unfortunately. We're
okay.
only just keeping steady.
Yeah, all right, all right. Thanks a million, Aoife McIntyre. Kevin Doyle, that's probably a grim, realistic assessment of things there. But on the other hand, there does appear to be, like, it's probably not everyone, but there is a certain sense across the board that there is an ennui there, and that if people are told again on April 5th that there's nothing more you can do, that they start doing it anyway.
No, I mean, Aoife's very cheery, but that was depressing, to be honest. I think there's a thing, Brendan, where we have, throughout all of this, we have lived in the moment. There was kind of that moment of fear at the start. Then there was kind of the moment of zen where we thought, oh, spending a bit of time at home is kind of nice. And then we had various moments where we blamed people going to Cheltenham, and we got through the summer. And then we had the moment where we were going to have a meaningful Christmas. And I feel like we're building up to quite a big moment now, because I feel that emotionally the country is spent. I feel it myself, and I've been called emotionally dead in the past. We are coming to a point, I think, where people can't take a whole lot more, and Dr. Ronan Glynn took the brunt of it during the week, where he kind of became the he was getting momentarily cancelled on social media because of that statement at the press conference, where he said people just need to do a little bit more. And now if you looked at the press conference in its totality, actually he spent most of that press conference praising people and saying that the vast majority of people were doing as much as they could. And even when he was asked if there was a risk from the protests we saw on St. Patrick's Day, that in 2 weeks' time we're going to see a big jump in numbers in the back of that, he wouldn't even get into that blame game. He said the story is actually that the most people stayed away from it. But
yeah,
it's very hard for the government.
So politically, what can they do here?
I don't think they can win, to be honest, Brendan, because they're trying to sell us this message of light at the end of the tunnel. And you know, it feels like we're digging that tunnel to China with teaspoons. And we've had so many problems. We had, you know, the European traffic light system. We had local lockdowns, which is, I think, what Aoife is kind of suggesting there again. We had the living with COVID plan, and they've all been cast aside. So April 5th is coming. And I think the government are at the point where they need to give people something more than hope, because the hope is dwindling. And I mean, the 5 kilometre thing, I think, for most people will be the big thing. And I'm not even sure that 10 or 20 kilometres will do it for people. I mean, on St. Patrick's Day, I saw hordes of young people in the park with their cans and their takeaways. And there was a time where I would have frowned at it and been kind of a curtain twitcher going, that's awful. Now I get it. But I'm looking at them and saying they need to do that. They need that release. But I can't go to Offaly to stand in a field with my parents purely because they live in Offaly. Now, if they live down the road, we could go to that same park. But why can't I drive there? And I think a lot of people are starting to assess within themselves how much more of this that they can actually give. And I think that's the problem for Micheál Martin. And he did say at a Fianna Fáil meeting on Thursday that they have to try and look and see, can they match the restrictions to the season? And I think that will be a big one. The evenings are getting longer. I think they'll have to do something on the travel thing and on the outdoor meeting up for people.
Yeah, Kate.
Yeah, I have to agree with Kevin. I haven't been to, I don't know when I was in Westmeath last, 2019, I think. And, you know, I think it's down to fairness. I think many of us are looking
but
on.
But it's not fair. The virus isn't fair.
I know the virus isn't fair, but in
Europe,
terms, obviously, the virus isn't fair and the virus is the problem, not NPHET or anything else. But I do think when people are looking on, they go, well, why are there people coming in from abroad? Then people understand the risks of people coming in from other countries, restricted or not. And then they're living within their 5 kilometres. And they go, well, why can't I go to Forban and see my parents? Or why can't I go to Charles Pass and see my parents and stand in a field?
Particularly as people's parents become vaccinated as well. I think
but
that's
also,
going to
we're all getting older. I mean, don't insult them now on the radio, but I see my own parents getting older every time I see them on the phone or that. Yeah. And I'm sure they see me getting older too. But I think there's a huge lack of fairness. But I also think, again, you know, we've seen a cycle of when things get tough, nasty neffit are blamed. And then it moves on to, oh, a push towards what people want, extension of the 5K, construction opening or whatever. But really, at the end of the day, if we track back and we have a year of data to look at now, there's the original variant, then we had the Spanish variant, the British variant, and now we have the fourth wave ahead of us. But we have an island nation. We are the envy of other European countries in that we have a border, a sea border around the country. We can stamp it out on the island. And I think people know that and they want to get back to living within their own country. And it will become, to my mind, a case of a bit like animal health, where you trade with countries with disease equivalents. So if we get to the same level as the North and they're the same level as the UK, there is no reason that you can't trade within an epidemiological bubble as such.
Yeah, you see, there was a time, of course, where we were like, how do we keep the North out of here? But now it's flipping to, they're going to be thinking, like, we don't want those people anywhere near us because they're all going to be vaccinated and presumably numbers continue to go down there.
Well, we'd hope that they would. But I mean, as it says on a number of the papers today, I mean, vaccines only offer one form of protection here. And it's very important, and I don't mean to lecture people, but we've had various measles outbreaks in Dublin and throughout Ireland in recent years. We don't just put our feet up and go, sure, that's grand. We have a vaccine. We let all those children become deaf or blind. Sure, it'll be fine. What we do is the public health teams.
But we're not putting our feet up here. The whole country's locked down.
Well, we have to make sure that we're not putting all our eggs in the vaccine basket, that we are collectively stamping out a virus, tracking it down and making sure that the aim of vaccination isn't to tick boxes. The aim of vaccination is to protect our most vulnerable, protect them from getting sick and having long-term impacts, but also protect our health service, which was about to fall apart mid-January.
Richard, you have a feel for people. You're out there up in the country and everything. Do you think people have had enough at this stage? Do you think they need to be given something, or is the case? Does it go back to we can't give people anything at this stage?
Well, I've noticed that, I mean, in January, February, March, a lot more people walking around the woods in the estates up in Virginia because they need to get out of their home. They need to get out. I mean, my wife works in public health in the UK, in NHS, and she's a therapist, you know what I mean? And, you know, there's a complete tidal wave of mental health coming our way with youngsters and middle-aged people and older people. I mean, we cannot lock everyone up forever. It's as simple as that. I mean, people have to go food shopping, for example, you know what I mean? Supermarkets, people have to get out. You just cannot lock everyone up.
Yeah, and look, in fairness, people are allowed to go food shopping now. The discussion building up now from people like Retail Excellence saying, I did a very interesting comment yesterday on Katie Hannon, where the guy from Retail Excellence was saying that what was essential at the beginning, we have to redefine essential after 3 months. Like, children's clothes might not have been essential a week into a lockdown. 3 months into a lockdown, children's clothes and shoes possibly become essential.
That is what's happening. We're all running out of clothes for the children, and it's fine when they're going nowhere.
I mean, it's European-wide what's going on at the moment. Trouble in Germany, trouble in the UK, trouble in Ireland. It's not just Ireland, you know what I mean? Yeah. Everyone is becoming incredibly frustrated. And there's an awful lot of people on the lower paid scales, Brendan, you know what I mean? Hourly paid people. And, you know, they're feeling the stresses, the financial stresses of this is starting to outweigh even your own kind of responsibility regarding this virus. People are feeling, you know what I mean, where the hell are we going here? You know what I mean? Their debt responsibility is just getting larger and larger and larger. And, you know, people are absolutely crowded by so many things coming their way that, I mean, don't stand in the park with a beer. I mean, please.
Yeah. It would strike you that there needs to be some creative thinking now about how to make life a bit more bearable for people, because this, I think a lot of people think at this stage, this is unsustainable. Okay, listen, we're not going to solve that one again today. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Richard Corrigan, be quiet, Richard Corrigan, for a minute. Kate O'Connell and Kevin Doyle. By the way, let's just sidestep everything for a minute. There's an interesting story that's kind of across all the papers, Richard, and this is about a row between the IFA and Aldi and Lidl. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean? The IFA have kind of tackled Lidl and Aldi regarding kind of own brand stuff. And of course, these supermarkets are damn clever, you know what I mean? If they see something really popular that's owned by an Irish company, or just say it's an Irish-owned company, a milk carton or a cream or something, they go and copy it, as in taking off, basically, a similar product line and selling it as their own. Of course, there's more profit in it for them, and
what they're doing, I think, is putting Irishy names on their milk brands and stuff. But are they not perfectly entitled to do that? And I think the milk is mainly Irish.
Mm.
They're cashing in on that the reputation that local produce
mainly
in Ireland.
That's mainly Irish.
Well, I think from my reading of it, no, I'm not an expert, but it's, some of it is going into the north to be processed and is coming back down here.
And a lot of it is coming from the north to be processed down here as well in huge amounts. I mean, you know, really, we take a large amount of the milk from the north and process it down here. So, but it's not, I don't think it's just that. It's the let's call them clever marketeers, because that's what they are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They see a good idea. They don't want to pay the full price for it. And they just copy something similar. And
they come up with their own brand. Like, that's what marketeers do all the time. Yeah. And it's milk. Milk is milk. Yeah. Like, it's a generic enough product.
Yeah.
But it, I suppose, is it a compliment, really, to the attractiveness of Irish produce, and that people have really gone back to wanting local stuff, Irish stuff, all that kind of thing?
Well, it's interesting when you say about Irish, you know what I mean? We start talking about kind of pan-nationalism on our rashers and sausages, which is really bloody annoying, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm of an age where, you know, park all that nonsense for a side, you know what I mean? You have made in Ireland, you know what I mean, on lots of products that really things are not made in Ireland, you know what I mean? Because of the European definition of what is what and what is a flag within every country. I got in serious loads of trouble around 12 years ago regarding this.
Yeah,
I asked for the abolition of Bourbia, and the Senate nearly called me for a meeting with them in Dublin, you know what I mean? And basically, when you ask for an abolition of a government body, basically, they should be selling food abroad as Irish and not worrying about what's going on in Ireland, because let the Irish people in Ireland worry about what they want to buy. But it's up to the companies as well to tell them what's good. I think there's great food companies in Ireland. We're good at one thing. We're good at anything got to do with grass-fed. We're brilliant at.
I
bring in the beef myself into my London restaurants, pallets of it from Hereford Prime and Tipperary. I've tried beef from everywhere. Lake District, Cornwall, whatever. Can't touch us. End of story. We do it really well.
Boris was a frequent visitor to some of your restaurants, wasn't he? Does he favour Irish beef?
Yeah. He's eaten plenty, I'll be honest with you. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's not as regular as he was, I'll be honest with you. He goes other places since he's been Prime Minister.
Yeah. Really, yeah?
Yeah, he used to come with one of his children. In fairness, he's very quiet. When he was
fun and harmless, Boris used to come into Bentley's, was it? But then suddenly we had to take him seriously.
I think Boris is really a clown. You know what I mean? End of story. You know what I mean? I'm not afraid to say that. You know, he's a lying journalist, basically. He's lied his way into office, and he's completely
made
a...
Well, you can't say he lied his way into office.
Excuse
me. He has a checkered history as a journalist.
I'm living there. I read the papers, you know what I mean? ERG and these bunch of lunatics, you know what I mean? And then you have Lord Frost dealing with the whole thing at the moment. That personally, as what I see about Frost is he's determined to bring down all protocols, all treaties with Europe, for them to renegotiate the whole thing, that's something that's more favourable to them regarding Brexit, because clearly they ain't happy with the deal that was done, and they're going to do everything in their power to get a new Brexit deal done in the next 5 years or whatever.
And equally, the view very much among those people in the UK is that the EU has been very, very hostile to them since Brexit, and there's an argument there as well.
What? That the EU is hostile to them? The EU behaved exactly like they should have behaved, you know what I mean? It's a union of European states, and you wanted someone to go, the Brexiteers wanted to go, let them go. But they didn't go nicely into the night. They went with their pots and pans and firecrackers and renegotiate. I mean, impossibilities the last 4 years. It's lucky there was a deal done at all in December.
And Kevin Doyle, of course, the Brexit hasn't could have been kind of just a disaster under other circumstances, but it's now affecting, I suppose, as well, the whole vaccination issue around Europe and everything else, and the rancor of Brexit is gone into that, and that was a big story this week as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, has kind of become the new bogeywoman for the UK press very much. But I think there's a lot of soul searching needs to be done on the EU side, more so, Brendan, than Britain. I mean, we know that they have had a kind of an almost Donald Trump Britain first approach to vaccines. And to be fair, Joe Biden has had a fairly similar one in America, albeit he's given a few vaccines to Canada and Mexico this week. But the truth of the matter is that the EU thought that we were going to play this on a level playing field and that everybody would look after everybody else in the spirit of goodwill. And I suppose the solidarity that perhaps we saw at the start of the pandemic, before we all started twitching our curtains and blaming everybody else for all our problems. And so the EU has exported 41 million vaccines to 33 different countries outside of the bloc.
And we don't have them. The US or the UK has exported nothing, as far
nothing.
As we know.
No,
there is a chain of stuff of raw material and stuff does seem to move around the world, but in terms of finished vaccines.
Yeah, and to put that in brass tacks for you, if rough sums, if that 41 million vaccines had stayed within the EU, that'd be around 450,000 vaccines for Ireland. So that's not an unsubstantial number when we're talking about only reaching the over 70s at this stage.
Yeah, and Kate, you were looking at that piece on the front of the Sunday Times, confidence plunges amid vaccine pause. And obviously, the Richard's friends in the UK viewing all of this gleefully the last week, and now that basically the EU had a kind of a fit of the rigor about the vaccine, and that it has really damaged people's confidence in it and damaged the whole rollout and everything.
Yeah, you would have kind of expected that being part of the wider European bloc and having that buying power and that diplomatic power and industrial power in terms of the pharma that's manufacturing, you would have thought that they'd have this in hand. But what actually happened was we're looking across, and I'm looking across, I'm envious of the UK, and I'm envious of, I suppose, how Boris has turned the corner, where, like, really it was a bit of a basket case 8 months ago, and, you know, a lot of very, very poor decisions were made, and it has had a subsequent impact on life and health.
Do you think that the suspension this week in so many European countries and the kind of the EMA, I know, kept expressing confidence, but it was fumbled by Europe this week. Was that another cock-up?
Well, I just think that this is going to be ongoing for as long as we have COVID in the world. We're going to have new iterations of vaccines, we're going to have new generation vaccines, and we will have obviously the trial data, but the best trial ever is what happened in the UK, and that was, to my mind, the most reassuring thing about the Astra vaccine was that 11 million doses had been
given. So was it a mistake
given
to stop?
No, it wasn't, because we have to live within the regulations and people have to have confidence in the regulations, but also...
Do you think this has given people more confidence in AstraZeneca?
I think in time it will, because I think in time other data, it's totally normal for post-marketing authorisation that there would be data collated, and it's normal, and even in, which would be the programme for government in 2016, there was a piece put in by Dennis Nocton, if I remember correctly, about people who actually are that small cohort of people that have actual damage from vaccines, to acknowledge the fact that there are side effects. And I know when people start a new tablet, the first question is, they go, and there's no side effects, and you go, well, there's a leaflet, and of course there's side effects with everything. And many experts have been on the radio during the airwaves during the week discussing, you know, the relative risk with medications, and the overwhelming evidence is that the vaccine far outweighs, the Astra vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine that are marketed, far outweigh the risks of COVID.
And the
message has to remain that COVID is a serious threat. Things haven't changed since last year, apart from COVID has got smarter.
Yeah, and I remember actually way early on in the vaccine journey, Killian de Gascoigne, when the initial results started coming out, saying, look, yes, this is great, but this is 30,000 people in a trial. When you get up to 100,000 people in a trial, you get 1 in 100,000 events, you get 1 in 1,000,000 events that we won't see now. So
they're, and they're more terrifying.
Kevin, do you think it was, I remember, like, I was sitting here exactly a week ago with Karina Butler, and I think it was kind of agreed that hopefully it was an overreaction to stop it. But to what Luke O'Neill has been saying all week, and he's writing again today, which is that the precautionary principle is all very well, but you have to take the danger on the other side in as well, and that it was dangerous to a lot of people to stop the vaccines, the vaccine rollout the way we did.
Yeah, Luke O'Neill's line is that it was like throwing away the fire extinguisher while the blaze is raging. And I think there's a lot of work now to reassure people. You see it in the surveys that the Department of Health have done during the week, that there's only, I think, 67% now saying they would definitely take the vaccine. We know we need 70% to reach herd immunity. So this line, which we've heard, I think, from a lot of the senior people in NPHET and in government, that the temporary suspension was necessary to reassure the public, that may be the case. And of course, medically, a sound decision to do it that way. But there's no doubt that, you know, you hear the jokes now. You hear people going, oh, you're getting the AstraZeneca. That's the one that doesn't work. And you hear that joke. And once that starts to permeate, you will get people who will go, I don't want that one. And of course, we know that there will be no option. If whatever vaccine you're offered, that's the one you have to take. It's not like Richard there. You can't turn down 3 and 4 and get another call next week. So it has done damage, I think. And that damage will take a little bit of time to repair. But hopefully, because as I said before, we live in the moment with these things. Hopefully this was just a moment in time, and in a month's time, we'll all be fine with AstraZeneca again.
Yeah. So in terms of living in the moment, Richard, if you're seeing things a little bit ahead of us, could you tell us that, does it feel in the UK now like that there is light at the end of the tunnel? Does it feel as if normal life as we knew it is going to resume?
I don't think anyone should be jealous of the UK. The UK has made a terrible, terrible mistake last year. Probably 175,000 people will have died in the UK. They've got their act together. It's taken them a long, long time. They've got their act together by keeping whatever they had for themselves. Europe made a terrible mistake. They should have got Germany involved from day one. Military, manufacturing, delivery. There was far too much chat, far too much talk. No one took it by the absolute ghoulies. The British brought in the army. They brought in the army probably last September, the UK, for all that distributing part. So they put the organisation behind it, and they're seeing the success now. But it's only been announced that I think over 50s, there's a month or so delay. Now, that's what they're saying right now. So they are becoming kind of, they are running out.
Yeah. Do you just think that a lot of countries haven't approached this right, like that go on a wartime footing and just do whatever it takes?
I think we should have went on a wartime footing. Basically, Europe, there was the commission have made some really fundamental errors here. There's no question about it. I think it really should have been a cabinet of its own just to deal with COVID. We'd have taken a much more aggressive approach.
Okay, look, that's all we've time for. Thanks a million, Richard Corrigan, Kate O'Connell and Kevin Doyle.